Welcome back to the show, everybody. Cairo Nights, the 8 o'clock hour here on Cairo Radio. My name is Aaron Mason. You can call me Mace if you like. Joining me for Mike Lewis, who is out this evening, is the one, the only, the world famous Jack Stein. What's up, Jack?
Not much, buddy. How are you? Are things opening back up? Up in the, I'm reading about King County applying for a modified phase two reopening.
Yeah, funny you should say that.
And I find that surprising.
Well, we've got a, it's not necessarily the most clear or concise reopening plan. It's got four different phases to it. Phase four being everything's hunky-dory and all open back up again. But it initially, when everything, when this all went down, Governor Inslee, you know, did the stay-at-home order. You guys had that in California. Don't go anywhere. Business is shut down. That's it. Stay home. Stay home. And what's happening now is you started to get a lot of unrest, people getting uneasy, especially in the more rural areas of the state, saying that, like, look, we're cool out here. Like, we're not living in a city. We're not rubbing up against each other day to day. So why are we still subject to these rules? And so they implemented this sort of phase program where if you qualify, which means you have a certain amount of no new cases over 3 weeks, less than 75,000 people in your county, your population, county by county, they could reopen faster and for, you know, economic reasons, basically, to get people back to work and open up businesses again. Well, today, King County, Seattle is in King County. It's the most populous county in Washington. We're not near the threshold quite yet for new cases. Inslee has modified it slightly since the beginning. So if you have fewer than 10 cases per 100,000 residents over a 2 week period, then you can apply to advance your phase. Well, King County's like, listen, we got a ton of businesses. There's a ton of money that floats through this county. We got to open back up again. Can you give me something? And so he's given this kind of like phase 1.5, he calls it, where and King County applied today for that phase 1.5. And according to Dr. Jeff Duchin, he's the King County public health officer. Basically, it's kind of a cheat. It's like a halfway to phase two. So you would get some of the phase two rules and then some sort of truncated or modified rules that aren't quite. So, for example, if we get into this 1.5, we get to do all the outdoor activities that are included in phase two. That means like camping and beach trips and all that stuff. But you have to have five or fewer people from outside your household that you aren't, you know, being quarantined with. It would allow gyms, you know, fitness studios to reopen, but for one-on-one sessions, like personal training kind of stuff. You won't have your big boot camp sort of classes, your CrossFits and whatnot like you used to. Restaurants, they can open to have indoor seating. There's been talk about outdoor, but not really about indoor. So they can open back up again, but instead of being the 50% capacity, which is the phase two rule, it's a 25% capacity for restaurants indoors. And same goes for barbershops and hair salons and things like that, 25% capacity. But the argument there, and I don't disagree, that I've heard from restaurant owners. In fact, there was a guy who owns, it's called Some Random Bar down in downtown Seattle. The guy that owned it got a whiteboard out and wrote down his month of April finances. He wrote down everything he spent, just opened up his books for everybody to look at. And he was operating on the takeout delivery kind of model that restaurants have been using to stay afloat. And he lost something like $15,000 or $13,000 in April, and he only would have lost 10 had he just shuttered his doors completely. So the argument from a lot of people who own restaurants and establishments like that is, great, we can open at 50% capacity, but we're still not going to be able to pay our bills. Does that make sense?
This seems so arbitrary, even in the shadow of the George Floyd protests, that if you're going to let that volume of people go outside and interact and clearly not be 6 feet apart from each other. I mean, any pictures that you see, any photographs that you see from anywhere across the country, these are people who are arm in arm for George Floyd. It seems incredibly arbitrary to me that you're going to let everybody out to protest, but then when a business owner wants to open his or her business, you say, well, you have 25% capacity and you got to apply, and then you got to prove to us that you can jump through 3 or 4 hula hoops consecutively, mm-hmm. and then maybe we will consider you the taxpayer. Maybe then we'll consider, if we like you, we'll agree to what you're proposing. I mean, that it seems like there is this intense, intense double standard when it comes to, I'm free to go outside and protest if I so choose, but if I want to open up my restaurant,
well,
not so much.
It's about, and this gets to a deeper argument too, but it's really about what the government has oversight of, right? Like, you, the government can shutter your business. If you don't follow their rules, they can shut you down. But the protests are individuals. Yes, it's big groups of them, but it's really individuals exercising their constitutionally guaranteed rights. So I think there's a little bit of a difference there, where you can't force a crowd to not go out and protest. You can recommend, you can say you shouldn't. Whereas if you're running a business that is sanctioned by the state and has a license with the state to operate, many licenses by the state to operate, that the state does have the authority to shut that down if you're doing something that the state considers to be risky. If you're too dirty, if you're serve, I mean, that's why restaurants have that undercooked meats and eggs thing that they have to have on all their menus. You know, it's sort of a jurisdictional issue to me.
Yeah, and then the argument becomes, at what point in time, as me, the restaurant, we've actually had people in California and specifically in Santa Cruz say, you know what, I'm just going to open up my sandwich shop. And if I get ticketed, I get ticketed.
Mm-hmm.
The idea behind it being that if enough of them do it and they get enough local attention, that it becomes kind of gross to see police walking in and putting up caution tape over a sandwich shop. And I think in the same way that it's gross when we see the militarization of police in places like Seattle, it should be gross to people to see police officers going in and arresting business owners for opening up their businesses when they are making concessions to the state. That same level of outrage, it's not equal, and I'm really curious as to why it isn't equal. Because as the police come in and break up protests, people go, oh, that's so awful.
Right.
That's so terrible. A local business owner, for example, the guy who owns the bar, where's his outrage? And does he not deserve the same amount?
Well, there's a constitutional right to protest. There isn't a constitutional right to own a business.
I mean, disagree.
You just put that in the margins.
I just put that in the margins.
In your pocket constitution. Yeah, I don't blame you. Listen, while we're talking about restaurants, there's an interesting thing that happened just earlier this week. Seattle City Council approved this measure that Mayor Jenny Durkan still has to sign, but it basically gives paid sick time to contract workers in Seattle, and specifically I'm talking about the third party like food delivery apps, Grubhub, DoorDash, even Instacart, people that go to grocery stores and that. And there's been a lot of talk during this whole stay home period about just the massive increase in demand on all of these companies. And you started to hear from people who were working there, and 98973, by the way, is the State Roofing text line. If you're somebody who works for one of these companies, Grubhub, DoorDash, Instacart, whatever it is, I would love to hear from you. But they were like, we're in harm's way. Like, what are we going to do? Like, this is this is the gig. We're overworked. We're getting into situations where we could potentially, more than your average Joe, contract COVID. And so the city council said, all right, we'll let you accrue one sick day for every 30 days that you work, and that will be contingent on your average daily income. They'll take a look at what you made last month, and then you can use up to 3 days of sick time before you have to, like you're a high school student, produce some sort of doctor's note or something like that.
So in California, we have something called AB5, which passed at the beginning of the year, says something like that. It makes contract workers, independent contractors, very, very specific. Mm-hmm. So you can no longer just classify any random employee as an independent contractor if you so feel like it.
Mm.
Uber, DoorDash, they're having a very difficult time with it, because they have tried to pigeonhole the independent contractor market. And as a result, you have kind of the same thing going on in California, where you have people saying, I work for this company full time. I drive 40 hours a week. I deliver food 40 hours out of the week. I deserve to be an employee and have all the benefits therein. Now, the problem is that can Uber keep its profit margins if it has to offer everybody health insurance and offer everybody a dental and so on and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
The numbers say no, but should they be entitled? I actually think that the independent contractor loophole has been exploited for far too long by major corporations.
I couldn't agree
more. Far too long.
Couldn't agree more.
So how could you? I think it would benefit. And honestly, if I could talk to the CEO of Uber, I might say, listen, you know, it's probably a good idea to actually make these people employees in the long run. But to try to empower the laborer, the delivery driver, mm-hmm. the taxi driver. I think that's the idea behind it. And people might say, well, Jack Stein, you're not being a very good capitalist if you choose to do that. In my heart of hearts, I believe, but I work for that company. I have pledged my allegiance to that company. Am I not entitled to a certain amount of benefits in exchange for my labor?
Right.
I would say yes. Other companies would say no, that's fine. But will I support those companies? Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not in the long run.
This is apparently a temporary thing, by the way. If the mayor signs it, it goes into effect within like 30 days, and then drivers can accrue that sick time throughout the city's civil emergency. So until the emergency is lifted, this is in effect. But from what I understand, at least from the story here in Eater, it looks like this is just a temporary measure while we're sort of going through the COVID thing, which, by the way, we're still going through. I mean, I haven't said coronavirus in about a week, it feels like, which is very strange to be in the middle of a pandemic and barely paying attention to it. But yeah, I like this. I mean, anytime you get into a situation that's as unusual as the one that we're in pandemic wise, then, yeah, you have to do some unusual things. And I'm a big fan of temporary measures. You know, while people are having a hard time, you help them out. And then when it's over, they're able to sort of get on, you know, with their lives. I'm all for it. I think it's a good thing.
Speaking of reading this.
Oh, yeah, go.
I'm reading this thing from Jeff Duchin. It is just so, I mean, allow restaurants to open indoor seating at 25% capacity. What difference does it make, truly, to let's say a restaurant that can hold 10 people,
right,
a tiny hole in the wall?
Right.
You're going to have four people. What is that? Two people in there at a
mm-hmm.
time?
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's absurd. And I also don't know how you enforce it. Like, what are you supposed to do? And I don't just mean the government or whoever would be responsible for keeping track of this stuff. I guess the narcs that walk around, like customer narcs, who walk around and report these kinds of things. But let's say you're a business owner. You have to employ someone to stand at the door with like a counter thing, like when you go into a baseball stadium and they're clicking how many people are in. What if somebody leaves and then you let somebody in and they were just going out for a cigarette and they come back and then you're overdone? Like, it's just vague. I don't get it. I'd like a little more specificity, or, you know, treat people like adults. I know people don't act like adults all the time, but I think there's something to be said about the idea of, like, you're let's say you open at 50% capacity. Let's just use that because that's an easier number. You open at 50% capacity. Well, do you think that 50% of your regular clientele are going to be interested in going back to a restaurant or something like that? I mean, that still remains to be seen. Who's still going to want to go out and get dinner? I don't know. I think I would.
So what we've had here is that there is a call-in line or a text line that goes to City Hall, and it's a narc line. It's a snitch line, and you you snitch on your neighbor if they're having a barbecue.
That's right.
Narc on the lady who wants to give haircuts one at a time, like what happened to my the woman who cuts my hair. And unfortunately, it has not worked well at all because people, it turns out, don't want to narc on their neighbors. They just don't want to. People want to get haircuts and buy sandwiches.
Right.
So hopefully they get rid of that sooner rather than later. But that's the point that it gets to where they're asking you, the citizen, like we're in North Korea, to narc on your neighbor or your local business.
It happened, man. Seattle loves narking. They really do. We have some nosy neighbors up in this piece. They are all about it. 360. Talking about the healthcare stuff, or we pass universal healthcare so we don't have individual car taxi companies dealing with healthcare. Can I tell you something? Just from now, I'm a fan of universal healthcare at the baseline, but let's just look at the idea of the labyrinth that is healthcare and why that quagmire is pushed onto small business owners, individuals, to try and understand, to navigate this plan, that plan. Like, it is just an unholy mess. It could, just for the sake of it being so much simpler, I'm a fan of universal health care, honestly. And then you save a bunch of money.
You thank for that? You could thank our good friend Mr. Barack Obama for putting that into place for everybody about 8 years ago.
Oh yeah,
remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That we could thank him for that.
Little ACA.
So thank you, President Obama.
Oh, I miss you, Jack Stein. It's good when you fill in. It's a fun
Thanks,
time.
Buddy.
Yeah, but coming up next, it's the 8:30 hour. That's not a thing. Stacey Joe, she's going to join us at 9. So Jack and I are going to talk about movies. K-pop, who knows? It's all on the table next. You're listening to Cairo Nights. Speaking of nights, welcome back to Cairo Nights. I'm the king of segues, Jack Stein. What can I say?
It's a good one.
Thank you. Thank you! That is the voice of the world-famous Jack Stein, filling in for Mike Lewis tonight. Mike has the night off. Jack, we were going to talk about something, and we didn't get to it. I just want to bring it up as sort of a question, because I thought it was really interesting. Wired UK had this article that talked about something called challenge studies. And I was unfamiliar with this, but it's something that happens when you or can happen when you develop a vaccine. It's where you purposely infect healthy volunteers with something in order to study the disease or to test a treatment or a vaccine. And there was a paper in the Journal of Infectious Diseases which said that, like, hey, maybe we should start doing this for COVID. Because one of the benefits, apparently, and it's a little ethically challenging, because one of the benefits here is that you could speed up the process of a vaccine by potentially a couple months, which could potentially save thousands of lives. The downside is you're infecting healthy people with a virus that really we don't entirely understand yet. What do you think about that?
It's funny that you bring that up, because I was talking to a very good friend of mine who's a doctor, MD, PhD, and I said, what do you think about this story that's going around about human testing? And he says, well, first and foremost, they need 35, 40,000 volunteers who would want to be infected with. And I said, why so high? And he said, well, in order to get accurate data, you need that amount of people.
Right.
Anything less than that, it's going to be too vague. It's going to be too obtuse. The information is not going to be what we need. And then he says, let's say hypothetically that we do come up with a vaccine. Is it going to be good for 6 months? Is it going to be good for 12 months?
Right.
There's not going to be enough information on the totality, the total length, the launch of the actual vaccine. So what do you do then? You would infect 30,000 people for a really good guess, maybe?
Right.
It seems a little weird.
Uh-huh. Yeah. This is what happens normally. There's like three phases to a normal vaccine development process. And phase one is you test a small group to make sure that it's safe, that it's not going to like put you out right away. And then phase two, you look for signs to see if it's effective, right? Then so you've checked off, well, it's not obliquely harmful. And then two, you see that like, oh, it actually triggers, you know, people's immune response. So it potentially could be an effective vaccine. And then three, and this is the sticky one. Three is you have to test whether or not the vaccine stops people from getting it out in the real world. And so you need to give people this vaccine that you're testing and along, because it's a scientific test, you'll have placebos, you know, a bunch of people get injected with like sugar water or whatever it is. And then you send them out in the real world and you just have to track them for a certain amount of time. And I don't know whether or not speeding something like that up, right, is on a guess, like you said, is necessarily the smartest idea. But then on the other side of it, it's like, well, if you've got folks who are willing to sign up for this potentially deadly mission to save humanity, I'm you know, hyperbolizing a little bit here, but not really, then why not let them? People do that all the time for a wide variety of things, right?
The compensation would need to be, you know, what that.
It's not just enough to save the world, Jack Stein. It's not just enough.
No, no. No. I would need some pretty sweet, you know, add-ons to my contract, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
But I wonder if this is, if in 10 years from now, and this is just me speculating, but if in 10 years from now, we'll be saying, man, we dumped trillions of dollars into fighting coronavirus, which is now potentially a virus that just floats around every year like the seasonal flu.
Mm-hmm.
Bad. Nothing. It's bad.
Yeah.
Not trying to downplay it, but we dumped so much money into it only to find out that nature has to take its course and it has to run through a population and people have to get it.
Well, we don't.
What? Go ahead. What will we do then? Will we have egg on our face then, saying that we dumped so much money and so many lives into just a virus? Just a virus. People get it.
Jack, let me hit you with an old adage, a time-tested adage. It's better to be safe than sorry. And that's exactly what this whole coronavirus experience has been, at least the response to the virus, right? Where we reacted very, very strongly to what was happening. I mean, the country shut down. Was that an overreaction? I don't mind, because I think it is better to be safe than sorry. And that to me is sort of the guiding idiom in this situation, if you will.
I'll loop this back around to the protests in the sense that if this was like Ebola, let's say, and it had something like an R-naught of 9 or 10, which is a huge infection.
Very, very infectious.
And then a death rate of something like 40 or 50%, I don't think that we would be seeing the level of protests that we're seeing right now. I think the protests are actually indicative of the fact that people don't really care that much about coronavirus anymore. Maybe they should. Maybe they should be more concerned about it. But I think that people have made up their own minds about it, and they've decided that a cause like George Floyd is more important than the fear of coronavirus. And I think that says a lot. And the fact that people aren't looking more into that and saying to themselves, well, there's millions of people out in the streets right now, not 6 feet apart, some of them not wearing masks the right way.
Uh-huh.
What does that say about the actual effect of coronavirus on the human? Not that much. I don't think people are as afraid of it as they were 2 months ago or even 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I would agree with you there. I don't think people are as afraid of it necessarily. But to me, to your point, I think that the protests speak more to how much people care about the issue of police accountability and everything that these protests stand for, which is primarily police accountability. I think that they recognize and care more about that than necessarily putting their health at risk. And I've also heard people argue that this is a health issue. I mean, I don't really feel comfortable speaking on behalf of people who take that as a stance. But from the very little that I understand about it, they go like, look, what's happening to specifically black men in this country is a health crisis. And I mean, I'll let people weigh it one way or the other. It doesn't bother me. You know, I think I'm seeing people doing what they can. Not everybody, obviously. It's a big mass crowd of people, and I'm sure they're spreading this thing all over the place. And I wish they didn't have to be out there in the first place. I mean, that's what it comes to. But I don't know what to tell you. Like, I don't think I said this about the folks who were out there at the open back up protests. I mean, there were people screaming in people's faces, and I think that is wholly irresponsible. And I would say that about the former protests and about these. You know, you have to be careful about that kind of stuff. We still are in the middle of a pandemic, but it's about picking your priorities and people capitalizing on this moment. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but people using this moment and this momentum right now, I think it's life or death for a lot of people. And they really don't see another choice, that they have to put themselves out there, that they have to get out there because there is no alternative. They have to do it.
I think we'll find out in 2 or 3 weeks whether or not this was all, because this in itself is an amazing experiment. It's amazing to see how many people will actually, unfortunately, contract COVID-19 from this kind of gathering, this kind of mass gathering. Right. So I guess we'll have to wait and see for 14 days.
Coming up, we got the Wheel of Segments still. We got Stacey Joe still. She's coming in at 9. She's going to talk about Drew Brees, because Drew Brees said some stuff today and faced some backlash. And it's a pretty serious conversation, but we'll have a little fun. It's Stacey Joe, so we'll have a little fun, too. But coming up next, more from your boy Mace and the world-famous Jack Stein on Cairo Nights. Stay tuned. I have a disorder,
you think,
Frank.
You're the Bee Gees? That's player.
It sure is. Baby, come back to Cairo Nights. It's that simple. It's your boy Mace hanging out with the world famous Jack Stein, filling in for Mike Lewis, has the night off tonight. How's it going, Jack?
I was getting a little bit too into that jam.
It's a solid jam. It's a real solid jam. Frank Shires is here.
Yep.
Of course, DB, as you know, holding it down behind the glass, because it's time to spin the Wheel of Segments.
Yeah, nice.
There's some
very smooth
excitement into it. Yeah, I keep her greased. You know, you have to. You have to. Tonight's a question of the day, and it's one. One of my favorite things about questions of the days is how it's a little window into each of us, right? That our answers kind of tell you a little bit about who that person is. And of course, we want to hear from you too out there. 98973 is the State Roofing text line. We've all been kind of hunkered down for a long time now. It's been months and months for most of us. And so I don't know about you, but I've been thinking about elsewhere in the world. And when things get open again and we're not afraid of going anywhere. Well, where somewhere you've never been and you want to go? And why? Where is somewhere that you've never been to that you want to check out, and why that place? Again, 98973 is the text line. Mr. Shires.
Sure. Actually, we were going to book a trip before the coronavirus shutdown. Australia.
That's right.
We were going to fly into Sydney, drive up to the southern end of the Great Barrier Reef and do a bunch of stuff there. And that is a trip we will take, I will take. It's just a question of when.
Right.
You know, it's not inexpensive. But, yeah. It's a fascinating place. I think the combination of the weather, the location, the animals, the unique creatures that are really cool to see.
Yeah. Islands are fascinating from, like, an ecological standpoint.
Yeah, but, you know,
and then just a giant island.
Yeah, I mean, calling Australia an island is hard because it's really, really big.
Evolutionarily speaking, a lot of evidence of that island life. What about you, DB?
My girlfriend Alicia and I have talked a lot about Austria. My girlfriend spent around a year or so after her high school. She went and lived in Berlin and just spent that time, obviously, you know, traveling all around Europe because of the trains and the accessibility there. And she went to the little town in Austria, basically in the Alps where they shot Sound of Music, and the hostel that she stayed at was playing the Sound of Music like on a loop on their TVs. And so she just found the magical quality of that to be so fun. And her showing me pictures of it, it's just like, it is the most breathtaking mountains that you have ever seen. And I just, it speaks to me. It calls to me.
It calls to him. Listen to that. 253, Death Valley, California.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I would think so. I like a desert.
Way past a desert?
253, Alaska. Alaska. I'm seeing Europe, Hawaii, all that good stuff. 207, the Playboy Mansion. I'll throw it out there.
Ooh.
That's what they said. I don't agree with you, but good on you for chiming in. Jack Stein.
I would love to go to the Philippines.
Really?
My old lady's half Filipino, and just being able to go and see, 'cause her family has deep roots there, and so being able to see place where her family is from and the language that they use would be fascinating. I'd be terrified, though, of the bugs and the fish and everything that could hurt you and harm you in any way, shape, or form, so I'd probably hide in the hotel, but I'd still like to go there just to say that I went.
Just to get the old passport stamps.
Yeah.
I hear that. DB kind of threw me off because you were talking about what you were talking about made me think of Amadeus, the movie Amadeus,
yes,
which is one of my favorite movies. And they filmed it in Prague. And it's just so beautiful. Like, I just want to see one of those old world, just beautiful cities like that. I never have. Mm-hmm. My initial answer that I was going to say is New Zealand, because
that would be cool.
It's like Australia, except that it's not trying to kill me. at all hours, there's nothing that, like, if you
Aaron,
look,
it has everything and it's incredible. Go
see, I knew it,
including great big earthquakes. It's wonderful.
I'm fine with that. I'll take that over like whatever 12-legged spider that also flies that they have in Australia. If you look up the world's deadliest blank, just start with world's deadliest. Click on whatever Google has up there, and I guarantee you it's in Australia. It's madness to me why people are there and have managed to exist for so long.
Well, they're on the outside of it, right? They're mostly around the rim.
Yeah. They've adapted. That's really the key here. Greece, says 425. Great value, great people. I need to get to that Mediterranean at some point. Mm-hmm. I'm a little concerned about the humidity. But I think I'll be okay. You go at the right time of year, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. All right, folks. We got more show. 9 o'clock hour. Our girl, Stacy Joe. Are we going to talk a little bit about Tiger King? Yeah, we're gonna. But then we have something serious to cover. It's all coming up next. Stick around, everybody. Cairo Knights. Watching it slowly.